Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. When we think about Darwinian evolution by natural selection, we tend to think about long geologic time frames with change taking place in the world of nature. But a new book by Dutch evolutionary biologist Menno Skiltshausen challenges that notion and tells us that not only is evolution taking place, but it's happening at an accelerating rate due to both the activity and engineering of human beings. The book is titled Darwin Comes to Town: How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. Skiltshausen has traveled around the world and studied the way in which city environments are driving rapid, fascinating genetic changes amongst all living things that have adapted to niches in the urban landscapes engineered by us. From species hitchhiking aboard ships to native species finding ways to survive in our cities, evolution is taking place in our backyards, neighborhoods, and urban infrastructure. We talked to Menno Skiltshausen via Skype. Menno, could you first tell us where are you right now? Where are we speaking to you from?
Oh, I'm in my study in my home in Leiden in the Netherlands.
And what kind of an environment do you live in?
Outside of my study, you mean? It's a city. It's the center of a sort of the 18th, 17th century center of the town, the city, small city of Leiden, which is a university town, sort of in between The Hague and Amsterdam. And it's an urban environment, though not as metropolitan as some really big cities.
And when you were a child growing up, where exactly, what kind of environment was that? When did you first start getting interested in nature, for example?
Well, I lived in an outskirt of Rotterdam, very close to what was still a fairly extensive agricultural area, fields and pastures and small little lakes and little swampy areas, lots of ditches, lots of water, reedlands. So I started getting interested in nature maybe when I was 11, 10 or 11. I started, you know, collecting plants and mushrooms and bird watching. And when I started going to secondary school, I had a very good biology teacher who helped me to get into entomology. So he pinned my first beetle for me. And then from that moment on, I started collecting insects. I did a lot of that in my immediate surroundings. So yeah, a small bike ride away from my home was an area that was green and natural.
And then what was it exactly that led you to want to write this book about the ecology of cities and how evolution is occurring in them?
Well, I'm an evolutionary biologist, so I study the process of evolution, of how species change over time. And often we have to do that sort of indirectly. We need to look at the patterns that we see in nature, you know, closely related species living in different places, sometimes on different islands, for example, and you can infer how they evolved and when they may have split from their common ancestor hundreds of thousands of years ago. But it's not a process that you can normally observe. So we're always very excited when you have these rare occasions that you can actually observe, that you can actually see a species change in its appearance over a time course on a human time scale. So in a matter of decades. When I started getting interested in that sort of examples, that sort of studies, then it became obvious to me that usually those cases are situations where humans force the evolution of wild animals and plants, because we change the environment very drastically, which means that animals and plants, if they can adapt, they do so very, very quickly. And in cities, you have all these factors coming together. There are so many ways in which we change the environment and cities are expanding, so their impact on the environment is increasing. So yeah, I begin to realize that cities are really like pressure cookers for evolution, and it's for for a biologist, a very exciting place to go and to study this process, this rapid adaptation. But also, you know, cities are, by definition, places where a lot of people live. So also the general public, whom I've written this book for, I think would be amazed to realize that something seemingly so profound as evolution is going on in their own backyards.
And one of the things I found really engaging is, you know, we don't think about it all the time, and even though it's kind of slapping us in the face, that we live in what's called the Anthropocene, where humans are changing the world. This is the geologic age of where humans are the dominant force on the planet. And your thesis is that we're kind of driving a lot of the evolution that's going on, you know, all over the place. But what I found was really interesting was you introduce us to this idea through the world of ants, because they're an engineering society, and the creatures that live with and around the ants, I think that you called them myrmecophiles. Is that right?
Yes, yeah, that's the term we use for other animal species that live inside ants' nests.
Could you just talk a little bit about some of the creatures that, because I found that fascinating.
Yeah, it is. And actually, that's one of the types of beetles I started studying as a school boy. You know, you can dig up an ant's nest, and then if you look carefully, you'll see these beetles, but sometimes also caterpillars or mites or snails or millipedes that live with the ants. And more often than not, these are really specialized species which have evolved over millions of years to carve a niche for themselves inside that ant community. Of course, ants, they concentrate a lot of food and other resources in their ant's nest. And if another species can evade detection by the ants and somehow prevent being chased or eaten by the ants, then they can find a lot of food. And there's a lot of species that have evolved to do so. They will either prey on the ants or their larvae or their eggs, or they may feed themselves with the food that the ants accumulate there. Sometimes they're more harmless and they feed on, you know, scraps and leftovers. But they've always adapted themselves to living in this ant community, usually in a chemical way. They basically have evolved to speak ant. They have this all these chemicals that these substances that the ants use to communicate with each other, which they usually do by smells and pheromones. These non-ant species that live in these ants' nests, they have also evolved the ability to produce those substances. So you have beetles that sometimes they resemble a bit ants, but they still, even to our eyes, they look very different. But the ants treat them as if they're other ants. They treat them as if they're also a worker ant that is hungry, and the ants feed them because of these chemical signals that these beetles are producing, which to the worker ants give them the message something like, "Hey, I'm also a worker ant and I'm hungry. Please feed me." And they do.
It reminded me of a movie I used to love as a kid. It was an old science fiction movie from the 1950s called Them, with the giant ants. The reason I thought of it is in the movie, they introduce one of the scientist characters as one of the world's foremost myrmecologists. And I had no idea that actually is what you would be if you studied ants, right?
Yes. There's the famous conservationist and naturalist E.O. Wilson, for example, is a myrmecologist. He's an expert on ants.
I wonder if he liked them.
I don't know.
The giant ant movie. Well, it made me think of it because it was like, you know, their take on it was we detonated the first atomic bomb in 1945, and somehow this genetically mutated these ants into giants that attacked the world.
Yeah.
Your take on it is a little more subtle, but we are affecting all of these creatures that inhabit our cities and the places around them. One of the most interesting places to me that you described was going through Singapore with a friend of yours along the shore there and all those different environments. And I think it were crows that you guys were observing. Could you tell us a little bit about the house crows? And they wind up in Rotterdam, right?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, so Singapore is a good example of a big city with a really urban ecosystem. When you walk around Singapore, you see all kinds of animals and plants that are tropical. So you assume that they belong there, but when you read up on them, you find out that most of what you see actually comes from different areas, from the tropics of South America or Central America or Africa or India or Japan, Southern Japan, or Northern Australia. Singapore, of course, is a city with a lot of trade, and this human activity brings in species, sometimes intentionally, sometimes accidentally. And the house crow is one of them. It's one of those species that has moved around the world, piggybacking on people, sometimes indeed intentionally. Intentionally brought by people to help control garbage, for example. And I think that's actually what happened in the house crows of Singapore. They were brought in from India during the colonial era by the British to control insect pests in plantations or maybe to control garbage. In any case, they were brought in and they multiplied and spread, and they're now a very common bird in Singapore, but also in many other tropical cities around the world. But it was still, it's still a tropical crow, very much linked to people. You can't actually find it in the wild anymore. So in that sense, they're like these myrmecophiles. They're like these animals which live inside ants' nests. And this is a species that has evolved a niche inside a human society. But you would still expect them to pick tropical human society. So it was very surprising that they turned up in the 1990s in the port of Rotterdam, which is, at 52 degrees latitude, so way outside of the tropical belt. And a couple hitched a ride on an Egyptian ship and disembarked and survived and multiplied in a small town just outside of Rotterdam for several decades. And they built a population of about 40, 50 individuals that were, feeding on French fries and building their nests out of shipping rope. And they were doing fine, which is strange because they're, a tropical bird. So it's interesting that they are so adaptable that they could actually survive in a city outside of the tropics. But unfortunately, in the end, the local authorities felt that they were likely to become a pest, because in other tropical cities they're often pests. So they decided to shoot them, to have them culled by a hunter. But the local population had, they started to like these crows, and they are very pretty and clever and comical. So there's been a long-lasting standoff between these official hunters and local people who wanted to protect those crows. In the end, over many years, I think the hunters have managed to shoot most of them, but there's still a rumor going on in that part of the city that some of them are surviving inside people's homes, and people are actually taking care of them inside their houses and probably are planning to release them once the coast is clear again.
Wow, and they're really smart too. You were describing how when the hunter would go out, he would have to wear disguises and drive different cars.
Yeah,
because they
as soon as he shot a few of them, they figured out that he was dangerous, and they started avoiding him and calling, so voicing alarm calls as soon as he arrived to warn each other. So he really had to, put a little funny hat on to evade detection or arrive in his wife's car rather than his own car, just to be one step ahead of the crows. And that's why it took so long for these just 40 birds to be shot by him.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Schlom. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Menno Skiltshausen. His new book, Darwin Comes to Town, examines how nature is adapting and evolving in the human-engineered environments in our most urban environments. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return to our conversation with Dutch evolutionary biologist Menno Skiltshausen. His new book, Darwin Comes to Town, examines how nature is adapting to our most artificial landscapes in the world's cities. One of the most fascinating stories in the book was about these crows that live in Japan. I think it's in Sendai where the earthquake was in 2011. Could you tell our listeners about what those crows do?
Yeah, that's a different species of crow. It's the carrion crow, which is a common crow in Northern Europe and Northern Asia. So they're native in Japan. And these crows have they've always had the habit of eating nuts during the winter, walnuts, which they would drop fly up and drop them on a rock. And then they break open after a few tries, and then they get to the flesh inside. And at some point, these crows in Sendai, well, first of all, they started learning that you don't need a rock. You can do the same thing with tarmac or with the street. So they started dropping them on the street. That was the first step. And then at one point, some crow, probably in a driving school where you had all these cars, you know, doing their figure eights very slowly, where the driving students were learning to operate the cars. The crows in a colony near that driving school, they figured out that they could simply put those nuts in front of the wheels of these slowly moving cars, and the cars would break them for them. So they didn't need to fly up and multiple times, because sometimes it wouldn't break immediately. They simply needed to put a number of these walnuts in front of the cars, and then the car's wheels would break them for them. And then the final step in this process of learning and adaptation to this human environment was that they started bringing these nuts to pedestrian crossings in the city, and actually putting them on the pedestrian crossing and waiting for the lights to turn red, and then the cars would move over them, and then they could pick up the flesh. And this behavior spread throughout the city and outside of the city as well. And I've also heard now that some crows in Germany are also doing it. So it's, for a while it was thought that it was sort of limited to that area, but probably sort of independently crows of the same species of crow in Europe have also learned it.
Wow. Maybe they have their own little, I don't know, satellite news network where they can
yeah.
They watch videos. Walk. Hey, look what those crows in Japan are doing. Why don't we do that here?
Yeah, but this is even if they do, then it's probably not evolution. It's a learning behavior, but that's not to say that there is no genetics involved. It might be that there are genes for inventiveness that are evolving in these urban conditions. Obviously, there's not a gene specifically for putting those nuts in front of cars, but it could be that population is becoming more inventive in general, and that's why they learned this particular trick.
Well, let's talk about evolution. What are some examples where we're really seeing these species that are interacting in our urban environments where we're seeing evolution actually speed up? Where you can give us examples of that.
Yeah, a lot of examples have to do with something that's very lethal to an animal. So there are examples of swallows, of which the shape of the wing evolves when they're close, when they're nesting close to a highway. Because short wings allow birds in general, not just swallows, to take off vertically much more quickly than if they have long, narrow wings. And swallows, of course, normally have these long, narrow wings, which allows them to soar and glide. But when they need to get out of the way of passing traffic, then it helps to have shorter and broader wings. And you see that these swallows are changing the shape of their wings over a space of about 30, 40 years when they're living close to a highway. Another example is insects that are attracted to light, to artificial light at night, which of course can often kill them or at least make them waste time, which they should be spending on finding food or mates. And we've seen that in cities, this tendency for insects to be attracted by artificial light at night is reduced. So, and that's also clearly an evolutionary effect. And finally, a third example would be fish that live in very polluted areas on the American East Coast. For example, there's a lot of PCB pollution from the time that PCBs were used a lot in industry, and they're still in the sludge, in the mud, in the bottoms of these of ports and estuaries. And there's a fish called the mummy chog, which has evolved the ability to withstand levels of PCBs that normally would have killed them 1,000 times over. They can withstand really high concentrations of PCBs. They've basically removed some links in the chain of their embryonic development, which normally are the links that are sensitive to PCBs. And by removing those steps from the process, they can still develop normally without being affected by these toxins.
Wow. Fascinating, but also kind of depressing.
Yeah, you could say it is depressing in the sense that it's very confrontational that we as humans change by the changes we produce in our environment. We cause sort of irreversible evolution of animals around us. On the other hand, of course, it's good to know that not everything will always go extinct. That species sometimes are able to adapt to all those changes and survive despite these lethal changes we enforce in their environment.
So I imagine when you go traveling to a city, you're on a field trip all the time.
Yeah. Yes. If I'm in a city, even though to me, to a biologist, a field trip is usually something you associate with pristine nature, but if I'm in a city, I'm always on looking out for animals and plants and little bits of vegetation and just to see what species are living there. And often I see that in cities that I've never been to before, I still see familiar species, which are these so-called exotic species or invasive species, which you find in cities all over the world, like the ones in Singapore that come from all the nooks and crannies of the world.
Do you have any favorite North American cities that you like to study in?
Well, I've spent some time in New York City, where you have these, for example, these European land snails, the garden snail. They've been introduced there. They've been introduced to several places in North America, including around New York. And I'm actually studying those snails here in Europe. Also, the way they evolve in cities, because the color of their shells is evolving towards more pale yellow color in cities, which probably has to do with the fact that in cities it's hotter in the summer than outside of cities, and the snails are better protected against overheating when they have a light colored shell, just like being in a white car. You don't get as hot as being in a dark car. So we see that in snails in Europe, those city population have lighter colored snail shells. And I'm sure the same is going on with these introduced snails in New York City. And another animal that I've actually never observed myself, but I know they're there and I know that they're evolving, is the white-footed mouse, which is a species that's being studied by my colleague Jason Munshie South in Fordham University in New York. And he's studying how these mice, which is a native rodent in and around New York, how they're surviving in city parks and how they're also evolving, genetically evolving and adapting to the conditions of the specific park that they're living in. So, for example, in Central Park, he's discovered that they have genes which protect them against aflatoxin, which is a toxic substance that's produced by a fungus that grows on discarded peanuts. So these mice there, apparently, they feed a lot on discarded peanuts from all the tourists and other people that are visiting the park. And natural selection has caused them to become resistant to this toxic substance that they're also picking up.
Wow. I'm also wondering about places like kind of where we live in more rural areas where, you know, I noticed that, you know, we have towns now that are set up right against wild areas, what we call the wildland urban interface here in California, because it's a problem with wildfires, because as you may have seen in the news, you know, a town right just a few miles from where I'm sitting right now just burned to the ground.
Yes.
And there's a lot of interesting interactions in these places where, like, deer, for example, are figuring out, well, we can't get hunted in these neighborhoods. And so they just move into the neighborhoods and start staying there. And coyotes the same way. They'll kind of start adapting to people being around.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. A lot of large mammals and also large reptiles and large birds are that formerly would never go into cities because you know, they're usually afraid of humans. They're beginning to figure out that you know, cities are often safer places to be than the forest and rural areas where they normally live, and they can find food there, and often it's a bit warmer, and so the winters are not so harsh. So yeah, coyotes and bobcats also in California are moving into cities. Here in Europe, we have foxes and introduced raccoons, which I think in North America are also an urban co-inhabitant. Yes, and these sort of, let's say, more intelligent wildlife, so the mammals and birds, which can really learn and figure things out, They're understanding that that cities can be good places to be. They can be safer. They can be more comfortable. There's sometimes more food around. So I think slowly, due to both evolution but also learning in these more intelligent animals, we see that the urban community, the urban ecosystem, is becoming richer and richer.
Yeah, I was kind of shocked to see in your book where I never thought of Chicago as being a place where you'd find coyotes, that there's a population of about 2,000 coyotes in Chicago.
Mm. Yeah. They can be very, very dense. And these large carnivores, they often, you know, feed on rats and you know, smaller mammals and birds, but also on roadkill. They can or sometimes they just scavenge. I mean, foxes in Europe, they mostly scavenge garbage and looking for stuff to eat there. And they can reach pretty high densities, much higher than in the natural areas where they would normally live.
Yeah, and it's interesting too that, like you said, they actually feel safer there than they would out on the plains, where they can be more easily hunted by other carnivores and humans. It just fascinates me to think of how they must figure out how to live amongst us without really being noticed a whole lot.
Exactly. Yes. And obviously, you know, except for that example of these house crows in Rotterdam, which were being shot by a hunter. Normally, hunters don't, you know, they wouldn't go and shoot animals in the city. It's too dangerous for the people that live there. So, yeah, that hunters would hunt their prey in rural areas, and that partly explains why, you know, these animals figure out that they don't need to be afraid when they're actually among the people.
Yeah, I had a large buck deer in my neighborhood for years, and this is anecdotal. It may not be accurate, but it always seemed to me that he, during deer hunting season in the fall, he would show up in my neighborhood, and I'd see him around all the time. And then when deer hunting season was over, I wouldn't see him anymore. And he'd only show up in deer hunting season. It was almost like he figured out. It's like, oh, it's time to go hang out in the neighborhood where I can't get shot.
Could very well be, yeah.
Let's get back to evolution itself, because you also have some interesting discussions about creationists, people that don't believe in Darwinian evolution. Have you had much go-arounds with those folks lately?
Not much, actually, no. Usually whenever I write something in the public press or popular press about this type of evolution, which is usually sort of quite subtle evolution. It's a single gene that is changing. We're not seeing the evolution of completely new species. Then creationists tend to say, you know, this is not really evolution, because, you know, that fish or that blackbird or that insect is still the same species. It has just changed a little bit, and this is what we call microevolution, and that's all fine. That's not really evolution. This is something that can be easily predicted, and we have no issue with that. But it's also not, you shouldn't call it evolution, because that's not what it is. And that's really a misunderstanding, probably an intentional misunderstanding of what evolution means. Evolution is defined as the change over time in the frequency of genetic traits. Now that sounds quite technical, but basically it means that any change, if you go from being 20% resistant to PCBs to 80% resistant to PCBs, or 80% of the fish in a population being resistant, that's already evolution. It's and then, of course, after a while, it's 100%, and then the next gene can just start changing. So if you had these accumulations of these changes, these adaptations over time, then you start seeing the evolution of an entirely new species. But that whole process of a new species evolving is made up of lots of these little steps, and each of those little steps is evolution just as well as the whole large-scale overhaul that you see in the end.
And that takes much longer time spans. And of course, we only observe these things over human lifetimes. But as you say in the book, we're speeding this process up. Is that the way I take it correct? That because of human beings, we're starting to speed a lot of this genetic change up?
Yes. I mean, in natural situations, evolution can also take place very fast. And it basically depends on two things. One is the generation time. So if a species can have multiple generations per year, like some insects do, then evolution can go faster, because, you know, generation time is sort of like the evolutionary clock speed, because every generation you see the effect of natural selection in the previous generation. You see which individuals managed to survive and reproduce and which didn't. So that's why humans evolve quite slowly, because we need, you know, 20, 25 years for the next generation to appear. But insects can evolve much faster, up to 100 times faster, because they can have several generations per year. So that's one thing. The other thing is that the stronger what we call the selection pressure is, the faster evolution goes. And selection pressure is basically the difference in survival between having a certain characteristic and not having a certain characteristic. And if that difference is very big, if you if you don't have that PCB-resistant gene as this particular fish, that you certainly will die and not have any offspring. And if you do have that gene, then you will be able to survive and have offspring. Then this gene for being tolerant to PCB pollution will spread very, very quickly in the population. And in just, 10, 15 generations of fish, you can change a completely non-resistant fish into a completely resistant fish. So the fact that we change the environment so drastically, we basically turn it into an extreme environment with a lot of challenges, but also a lot of opportunities that are completely different from what species are used to encountering in natural situations. That's one of the reasons why evolution in and around cities can proceed so incredibly fast.
After a short break, we'll conclude our interview with Menno Skiltshausen. Menno's the author of Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. Dr. Skiltshausen is a Dutch biologist who specializes in studying how evolution is actually accelerating in our cities and towns. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. I'm Dave Schlom, and this is Blue Dot. Let's continue our conversation with Dutch evolutionary biologist Menno Skiltshausen. His new book, Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution, examines how our cities are not only influencing evolution, but accelerating it.
One of the things I was also fascinated by is we've been hearing in the United States a lot about bed bug infestations. And they're a real problem and a nasty, icky thing. You tell a story in here about where they evolved originally. Could you share that with us?
Yeah, bed bugs and some of our other animals that you find in our homes are really cave animals. So a lot of the species that survive very well in these sort of dark, enclosed, rocky spaces, which we call homes, but which are actually a recreation of the caves that we evolved in, are also the habitats where many animals survive very well, which we probably brought with us from those caves. So bed bugs, for example, are parasites, they're blood-sucking insects, which initially lived on bats. So there's still a lot of bed bugs that live in caves and they feed blood from bats. And when we started living in caves, they also started feeding on us and probably adapted to using us as their main source of food. And then when we gave up on living in caves and started building our own caves out of brick, they came with us.
Another interesting thing in the book is you talked about there are biologists who, of course, when you think of biologists, you think of people going out in the wild that want to go study in pristine nature. And it sounded like there was kind of somewhat of a pushback against you and your friends who were doing this urban biology. Is there some kind of little conflict there?
Well, of course, the what we're studying is how species adapt to all these terrible changes that humans enforce on the environment. My book is full of stories, success stories of species that have managed to evolve so that they can continue living in these completely artificial environments. And of course, the danger of that, and that's a realistic danger, and some of my colleagues have been telling me that, is that, you know, this message could be misused by people who say, well, you know, nature adapts, so it doesn't really matter what we do with the environment because those animals and plants will simply evolve and they will continue living happily in a changed state. And that, of course, is not true. The examples that I've mentioned now to you, but also in my book, are the success stories of species that have been able to evolve. But for every successful adaptation, there are probably dozens of species which cannot adapt to these changed conditions, and they simply disappear. So what we see in cities, even though they're richer in species and biodiversity than we think they are, it's still a very specific set of species that manage to live with us. It's not the rich list of flora and fauna that you would find in the habitat that cities have replaced.
Well, you mentioned flora, and we've been talking about lots of insects and critters of various kinds. I like my technical term there for them, critters, as I talked to a biologist. How about plants? Are plants doing some interesting adaptations to city life?
Yes, they are. Of course, plants cannot move, so they usually they have to adapt even more strongly to the conditions in which they grow and live. So one example is our plants like dandelion, but also hawksbeard. These are plants which produce these yellow flowers, which then after they finished flowering, turn into these plumed seeds. So seeds with a little parachute. And also sometimes they produce, in the same flower head, they produce seeds which don't have a plume, which are a bit heavier and which fall straight to the floor. So the ones with the plume, they will, little parachute, they will float into the wind, but you have also seeds produced by the same flower which fall straight to the ground. And what we see in cities is that these plants of these species, they start producing more of those heavy seeds which fall straight down and don't drift away in the wind, which probably has to do with the fact that if you've managed to find a little patch of soil somewhere in a city center to grow, then all around you is probably going to be tarmac and places where your offspring cannot germinate. So actually the best place for your offspring to be is right at your feet, at your foot, because at least there's a little bit of soil. So these heavy seeds usually manage to germinate, whereas these light ones that float away, they will land on the street and they will not germinate. And this has caused this natural selection to produce a shift in the proportions of small and heavy seeds that these plants make.
Could you, if somebody like me who's not a real cityphile, but I love nature. For anybody that wants to go, when they go visit the city, say San Francisco, for people here in Northern California, could you give us some tips of things we might kind of be on the watch for, to observe, so where we might appreciate some of the interesting natural things, the creatures that are inhabiting our urban world, things we could look for?
Well, one thing that you can almost always see is the city pigeon. You know, that's a ubiquitous bird. It's actually a native bird in Southern Europe, where it evolved to live on rocky cliffs. And you know what? Cities are full of artificial rocky cliffs, so city pigeons do really well there. But one thing that they're sensitive to is pollution by heavy metals. zinc and lead, which you find a lot in cities, of course, originally from a lot of lead pollution from petrol, from fuel, from gas that used to have lead in it. But zinc is still being produced to put on iron lampposts and electricity pylons. So cities are full of those heavy metals, and the birds, they ingest that through their drinking water. And it turns out that pigeons are able to detoxify their bodies from these toxic heavy metals by incorporating it into their feathers. Because the melanin, the pigment, the dark pigment in their feathers can bind to zinc and to lead. And once it's in their feathers, it's harmless. So it actually extracts, when they grow a new set of feathers, this extracts this metal from their body, from their blood, from their system, puts it into the feathers. And it turns out that the darker types of pigeons, the ones which are genetically predisposed to have these darker feathers, you know, the dark gray versions of the city pigeon, they have more melanin, so they can also extract more of those heavy metals from their system, and they can survive better. So the result is that in big cities where there's a lot of pollution, you see a higher proportion of these dark pigeons. So you could easily, let's say, usually when you go to a big city, if you start counting how many light gray and how many dark gray pigeons you see, you find more dark gray ones than if you go to a much smaller, more rural town where you will also find these city pigeons, but there they usually are lighter gray. So that's a very easy little urban evolution experiment that almost anybody can do anywhere in the world.
Wow. Well, we're almost out of time, but before we go, really enjoying the book. I love the fact that the chapters are relatively short, and they each have like really cool themes to them that kind of build on each other. Like you've got titles that are kind of humorous, like "If I Can Make It There," you know, the old New York, New York song. And yes. And of course you have "Sex in the City." You got to have that chapter.
Yes, you got to have that chapter.
What's the main takeaway you'd like readers to take from this book?
I guess the main takeaway would be that evolution is not something that you need to go to the Galapagos for, or that you need to be a paleontologist for to study fossils. It's happening. It's a very, very ordinary, mundane process, and it's going on all the time, everywhere around us. And it's also happening in your own street and in your own backyard. And if you have eye for it, you can actually see it happening.
Well, Menno Skilthausen, thank you so much for joining us to talk about your book, "Darwin Comes to Town: How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution." It was really fun to talk to you.
Same here. Thanks for having me.
Hi, I'm Sky Schofield, Blue Dot's editor and engineer. As you may or may not know, our intrepid host Dave Shlohm lived for many years in Paradise, California, the site of the recent devastating campfire. Dave took a moment recently to share his thoughts surrounding the fire and would like to share them with you now.
Everywhere I go in the North State, I overhear the conversations. They usually feature these words: lost everything. The unfortunately named campfire has put the entire area in a state of shock. I'm lucky. I have a roof over my head and a vocation. But my memories of Paradise haunt me because it was my home for many years. I spent my summers in Paradise with family beginning in 1968 before moving there permanently in 1977. I'll never forget the moment I got out of a car after a long drive from LA. It was 2 a.m. and I looked up with my 8-year-old eyes. Set against the silhouette of pines was something I'd never truly seen: a dark night sky and the Milky Way. My summer days were spent fishing the nearby creeks and cutting firewood with my brother. Paradise was beautiful, with majestic old ponderosa pines, lovely flowering dogwoods, and apple orchards. When I first arrived, I think there were 3 stoplights, 2 of them pretty new. The population density was low. It was a mountain town. It was home. My children were born there, my parents passed away there, and my granddaughter was just born there a few weeks ago. The climate was great, too. Real estate agents sold it as a place above the fog and below the snow. That was back when it was foggier in the valley and snowier in the mountains. But that, too, has changed. For many years, I owned a horse in Paradise and used him as a secondary mode of transportation. I remember epic rides down into the canyon of the West Branch of the Feather River, over Sawmill Peak and into Lake Concow, and back. I keep thinking about that since that was the same route the embers of the campfire took decades later. I worked for the local papers, the Ridge Gazette and later the Paradise Post. I was the sports writer there in the early 80s and got to know many of the wonderful educators and coaches at Paradise High School. I had a paper route too, the upper part of Paradise, Magalia, and virtually all of the Upper Ridge. In the past weeks, I haven't been able to get my mind to stop replaying that paper route and all the little homes tucked away in the trees that I know are mostly gone now. As the 80s wore on, I went to CSU Chico and got my degree in geosciences. Paradise was starting to burst at the seams with more and more development. The little apple orchards were mostly gone, replaced by housing and shopping centers. You couldn't really see the Milky Way from town anymore. And of course, there was always talk of what would happen if a fire came to the ridge. Too many people, too few evacuation routes. Lucky for me, I left Paradise and moved to Tehama County, where I teach at Corning High School. A few weeks ago, I was teaching a lesson on the megafires that have devastated California, telling the students that Paradise scared me more than anywhere. We discussed the four major causes for these fires: a decade of punishing drought that's dried and stressed the vegetation, the wildland-urban interface, places like Paradise where people want to live in the hills surrounded by forest, more than a century of poorly managed fuels that should have been burned in small fires frequently, and finally, the layer of climate change that some public officials choose to either deny or at best sidestep. But it's a fact that the average year-round temperature in California has increased, a gut punch to drought-stressed plants. There is hopeful talk of rebuilding Paradise, and people will naturally want to return, but should they? And if so, will it be a truly fire-resilient community or just developed to get folks back into their homes as quickly as possible? These are hard issues to deal with. If a new Paradise rises from the ashes, I hope they plant more apple orchards than shopping centers. Thanks to our guest, Menno Skiltshausen. He joined us via Skype from Leiden in the Netherlands. Skiltshausen's book, Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution, is available from most major booksellers. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in Northern California. You can check out this and past episodes on our website, mynspr.org. Never miss an episode. Subscribe to us at NPR Podcasts via the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by Sky Schofield. Wherever you're hearing this, I hope you will do whatever you can to support relief efforts for the campfire that has devastated so many of our listeners. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.